A History of the World from Lockdown. Chapter 1. The Sad and Heroic Saga Begins. Once upon a time, there were some omnivorous hominids in Africa. They just kind of bummed around for a long time with occasional attempts at territorial expansion. Then a species of hominid emerged with a larger brain than the others. This had advantages for problem solving. It also turned out in the long run to be really great at problem creating. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. The brain of this hominid was not just bigger, but it pulled a particular unusual trick, which was to become aware of itself in a new way. This presumably helped with the problem solving. It enabled the hominids to see themselves as active agents in their environment, giving them increased powers to shape their world. This power to shape the environment would also turn out to be, let's say, something of a mixed bag. For the moment, the brain was mostly used to help find plants, kill animals more easily, and create basic tools and shelters. The big-brained animals continued to just mooch around in Africa for a long time until some particularly energetic, some might say troublemaking elements, went for territorial expansion again. They rubbed up against some of the older hominids in the process. Debates still rage about whether this was friendly interaction or more aggressive, whether they banged much and how many of them were enjoying that and so on. The point is, they got out there and spread themselves around. It turned out that the big brain could help the animals adapt to all sorts of environments, even really cold and rainy ones with short days, like Glasgow. The humans who reached the cold, sunless wastes of the north had a tendency to lose their skin pigmentation as they desperately tried to collect more vitamin D from the scarce resource of sunlight. This would eventually produce a corner of the world full of freakishly pale humans. It later came to be known as Europe. However, the freakish paleness and other aspects of European culture would develop only very slowly. In fact, nothing of real interest happened in the world for a long time, except for an ice age, which was kind of harsh and rendered many northern places even more uninhabitable than usual. Chapter 2. We grow things and agglomerate. After the Ice Age, nothing much happened again for quite a while. History is mostly blanks for a long time and then gets more crowded later on. Eventually, some humans in the far west of Asia hit upon the idea of farming. So when you take wild animals or plants, breed them to suit you better and control their reproduction for your benefit. Few animals besides humans and ants do it, and only humans use their big brains to constantly improve their methods. It has to be said that improvement here depends on whose perspective you're looking from. Lots of animals and plants don't like farming very much because it involves taking up space they would have wanted. On a systemic level, some types of farming are more sustainable than others, and for a long time, the farming in the far southwest of Asia was small scale, and the other animals and plants didn't mind too much. Meanwhile, humans hanging around in Africa and Europe started to create art. This was fun, particularly because nobody had yet thought of putting the art in a gallery in order to isolate it from everyday life. Nobody knows what most of the ancient art means, but that's fine because it's one of art's defining features. Quite naturally, the humans also created villages because they always had a tendency to hang around in packs. Sometimes those villages turn into small towns. There was a bit of to and fro between small settlements and big settlements. Places like Jericho got going early. Unlike Jericho, which is still there, most of the early versions of towns didn't last long. These bigger settlements had their pros and cons. The biggest problem was that cities tended to be run by total pricks. So every now and then people would get sick of cities, give up on them, and go back to villages, which still had pricks in, but pricks without power, which is the best kind of prick. Most of these towns or cities were again in Southwest Asia, which was the cultural hub of the world for a long time. In Europe, people were mostly still throwing rocks at each other, though Ukraine did develop a city, for no good reason that we know of, except that sometimes stuff happens somewhere, hence history. Eventually, a bigger change happened in some of the cities that survived longer. Some of the pricks started ordering other people around even more because it made them feel special. One of the things they ordered people to do was build much more complex farming systems, including irrigation channels that move water around. These guys were probably quite unlikable in many ways, but they used the increased productivity of their new farming systems to justify their dickishness. Everyone was told they were better off now, even those who weren't. This set a pattern that would be repeated a bazillion times in the coming years. So I learned in school one of the pricks was called Ozymandias or something. He thought a lot of himself, but now he's dead. All the pricks are dead, as well as the non-pricks. That's how history goes. Chapter 3. The rulers start ruling. So a few people decided to scale things up and go for the first empires. First in Akkad, Mesopotamia, then in Egypt. The Egyptians created some big stone pyramids, so we have a weird reverence for them, which we should probably question. Think about what it takes to build pyramids. We don't even have to assume they use slaves. It seems the slaves of the Egyptians were used for other tasks. What it takes to build pyramids is the ability to command the labour of vast numbers of people. And who has the right to command so much labour? Well, nobody by birth. So we have to assume that force underlaid the structures behind the pyramids. Oh yeah, you can argue that, well, the pyramids were built by peasant farmers when the Nile was flooded and they couldn't work their land, so yeah, maybe that's what they wanted to be doing. Well, the thing is, peasant farming is hard work. Like, really hard work. And if you get a chance for a holiday, frankly, you're going to take it, you know. If the flooding means you can't work for a bit, then it's actually a relief. But there were no holidays for these people. The floods have come, okay, then move these million tons of rock. That's not the sort of arrangement that people just fall into. That doesn't mean they were necessarily violently driven as they worked the stone. Systems of violence are more complex than that. Obedience is inculcated by force from childhood, but violence often becomes enshrined in law and custom until people don't notice it anymore. People build pyramids because in the end, the price of not building pyramids is too high. And it takes a total asshole to create that situation. Or rather, a collection of total assholes. Sometimes a collection of assholes is called a government. Government can have other meanings too, although it has a tendency to strongly enshrine assholedom. The reasons for this would only become clear later. So anyway, the Egyptians spent a long time ruled by arseholes, resisted only by a few surrounding arseholes and by the mysterious sea peoples. Seafarers have often been more independently minded than those bound to the land and to kings. But we don't know a lot about the sea peoples, whether they fought for freedom or for their own kings. Eventually, other parts of the world began to catch up in the arsehole stakes anyway. Empires spread in the Middle East, Asia, even parts of the backwater of Europe. These empires had some specific tendencies we will go into soon. But let's look first at some of the heroes of the age. There were vast areas of the globe at this time not covered by empires. In fact, the majority of the planet was still producing settlements that were mostly villages, sometimes reaching very small town size. Many of these had to operate on the periphery of the great, in inverted commas, empires. Oddly, given that we're used to thinking of these empires as great, most of those on the edges of the empires did not want to join those empires. They just got on with living their village life in which, and this was presumably important to them, control of their lives was very localised. That's not to suggest the villages were utopias. They could already be quite sexist. Some of them spent too much time fighting other villages. There was hunger when harvest failed. But humans have a strange liking for dignity, self-respect, autonomy. They'll sometimes put up with a lot for that. The empires were better at creating storehouses of food for drought seasons, but still people didn't rush to join them. Mostly, people still had to be forced into the empires, often with extreme violence. They didn't necessarily resist leaders, even small bands of humans have those, but many did resist rulers. So let's think of all the nameless people in this period who resisted the advance of empires. Think of the thousand struggles for freedom waged in those backwaters of history. The countless acts of heroism would never be written down because the heroes did not know how to write. Perhaps they were memorialised over a few generations in local oral history, but that would rarely have been the motivation for their struggles. They simply wanted to keep their dignity and freedom. Many of them succeeded, and many of them died trying. Chapter 4, A Note on Civilization. This brings us to the general category of civilization. And when you think about it, there isn't any stranger category in the history of history. All it means on the face of it is that people produce more objects, yet it carries with it hints of superiority. The Indus Valley civilization, which flourished sometime after the start of the Egyptian Empire, spread across a large area and then died. What was the experience of the people who lived in it? We do not know. Were they well fed? Were they happy with their lot? Were gender relations good enough that they had good sex lives? Did they have powerful rulers? And if they did they like them? We don't know. Yet because they produce objects that still exist, houses, temples, pots, carvings, we see them as worthy of attention. We big them up with that term of respect, civilization. Well, the birth rate increased during the Indus Valley civilization, and so did the death rate. What human joy and misery do these simple facts hide? Historians have largely been uninterested. They're busy seeking for the keys to later civilizations, for the succession lines of dickish kings, or for the most advanced technology to characterize the civilization. They made water wheels. Ooh. Some of us might, shockingly, choose to characterize a civilization by whether or not people enjoyed being part of it. Anyway, around this time, when the rulers started ruling, people were also inventing writing. It was invented independently in Mesopotamia, Egypt, China, and Central America by people probably cleverer than you or I. Yeah, inventing writing is considered to be something to boast about. But it's not always clear exactly what's superior about it, or what prejudices we're unthinkingly reproducing through trusting those who write. Let's face it, when someone can not only write, but make their living from writing, they will insist on seeing writing as something to get all hoity-toity about. Perhaps there are some definitely positive things about writing, but most of the better effects were not to be seen until thousands of years later, when the printing press was invented. There were some clear downsides to writing. Violent, powerful people have historically had more access to it. They used it to glorify their killing and raping, and also to keep accounts to help in their systems for fleecing the ordinary people. The purpose of writing was not to improve the lot of humans in general. Perhaps we should at least bracket our respect for it, you know? Let's leave the verdict open for now.